When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From the heart of Bed-Stuy, you're listening to We Love Radio.
Doing the yin and the yang, the hip and the hop, the stupid fresh thing, the flippity flop. Oh, I have today's forecast for you. Hot!
You can talk about film with a philosopher's zeal, or measure them all by box office appeal, but for once in your life,
be real!
Welcome one and all to a movie reviewing, reappraising, and genre-hopping podcast on the Playlist Podcast Network. This is Be Real. My name is Chance Solempfeifer.
And I'm Noah Ballard.
And we are here in the year 2021. At the midway point-ish of a pretty hot summer, Noah. We got this idea when we recorded an episode a few weeks ago where you and I had basically both sweat through our clothing. We're going to try to do a mini-pod afterward and just simply could not do it. And then I think afterward you texted me like, hey man, what if we did a podcast where all the movies were super hot?
And here we are. Yeah. And I made it really specifically, parenthetically, by accident. these movies are all about beating the summer heat in New York City.
Oh, my God. If you can melt into a sewer there, you can do so anywhere.
That's quite right. Yeah. If you can perspire through your clothing here, you can do it anywhere.
Yeah.
And so, of course, we picked 1955's The 7-Year Itch. Do the Right Thing from 89 and from the same year. I can't believe we haven't done this movie already. Weekend at Bernie's.
You would have thought that we'd teed up some sort of like Dead Man on Campus kind of category with Weekend at Bernie's, but we had not.
Well, maybe we should just stop recording right now to save
it. Go do that episode?
Let's just go do that episode. We'll do it in the fall.
Sure. That makes sense. So Noah, I think that these movies are all about
heat,
psychosis of the heat, are they not?
Oh, like raptures of the heat?
A little bit.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's all about the crazy you get when you're so dang hot that like there's nothing else to be done.
A lot of id ventures forth, I would say.
Yes.
Just as some set dressing at the top. I mean, Portland had a record-breaking heat wave, like unheard of to have like 3 days in the like 108, 112, 115 area in a part of the country where the average summer temperature is like 77 and most homes don't even have air conditioning. But then like right at the end of that, New York had a terrible heat wave, and you'll probably have a couple more this summer if we're being honest. What does it do to you?
I feel great.
Oh, great. Unaffected. Perfect. Then I'll answer.
Unaffected. I have air conditioning in every room. We just don't look at the electricity bill. No, it's interesting because like being outside, especially in New York, like it's like inescapable, mm-hmm. you know, especially if you're at the mercy of public transportation, which like in other times I certainly would be. But like just like gasping between overly air-conditioned office building, and then like you run around to the subway stop, and then like usually the subway itself is like not that cool, and it's like you're trying to look nice but you're soaked in sweat. It's yeah, it really is something truly awful. I don't know why people would spend a summer here, which has of course yielded a lot of these movies.
Mm-hmm. I do find that there's weirdly like something comforting and quaint, which is odd to say, with most of these films, though, are about how like people still manage to be around other people, as dangerous as that is. It's like kind of everyone's in the same boat. And I gotta say, at the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest last month, it was just a lot more apocalyptic. It was just like no one on the street for days and days and days. And people were like, sheltering, and several hundred people died. So there's something, there's something perversely comforting about, like, at least these people in these movies are going to the movies and getting in squabbles with their neighbors, and at least people have other people.
Well, it's interesting, too, to look at all three of these movies through the lens of the way the climate is changing and, like, where the tension erupts in these movies and how kind of terrifying all of them are, knowing that this is just kind of the beginning of a longer series of conflicts, whether they be, you know, as unimportant as the battle of the sexes and married couples, or it's like, you know, the way people go about eating pizza and living their daily lives. Weekend at Bernie's, not a climate change film.
I don't know how hot it is supposed to be in the other two, but it is in Do the Right Thing, which I think does the best and the most with the temperature. And Spike does the shot of all the different newspapers with their heat wave puns. I think it's only like 99, though, to be frank. Isn't it say 99, 100?
Yeah, and even then, it's too dang hot. I'm going to take it back about Weekend at Bernie's, though, because there is a scene where Andrew McCarthy's like, I didn't know the tide was going to come up so high.
You're right.
So like, and it's like, well, you didn't know that because of the rising sea levels, because of climate change.
And that is why Bernie's corpse drifted up behind Silverman and that woman who looks like Allison Williams when they were making out.
Incredible. Incredible.
Well, Noah, it was 130 degrees in Death Valley over the weekend. That's a new record. So why don't we jump into this show title for title, shall we?
Careful, I had my appendix out last year.
It's the funniest comedy since laughter began. Of a wife who spent the summer away, and a husband who stayed home to play and play and play.
Because now I'm going to take you in my arms and kiss you very quickly and very hard.
Wait a minute!
With Marilyn Monroe soaring to new heights as the screen's most lovable laugh-getter.
Everything's fine. A married man, air conditioning, champagne and potato chips. It's just a wonderful party.
Tom Ewell, who created the original role on Broadway. Evelyn Keyes, Sonny Tufts, Robert Strauss.
This is what they call classical music, isn't it?
Yes.
I could tell because there's no vocal.
Shh. Don't talk. Let it sweep over you. Relax. Go limp.
Like this?
I've been married for 7 years, and I'm afraid I'm coming down with what you and Dr. Steichel call the 7-year itch. What am I going to do?
1955, the 7-year itch. When his family goes away for the summer, a hitherto faithful husband with an overactive imagination is tempted by a beautiful neighbor. It should be said that in this IMDb synopsis, neighbor is spelled with two B's.
is that like a breast joke, or we think that that's just accidental?
Neighbor.
Right.
And of course, the neighbor is Marilyn Monroe, the most famous woman who's ever lived.
Famous, so famous at this time. If you ever wanted to know, like, oh, 1955 is a long time ago, I know she's a celebrity. Like, what was the actual like breaking point of her celebrity in the last 10 minutes of this movie, when the guy who's been upstate with Richard's wife comes back in? Does he say, you might as well have Marilyn Monroe in there? Or maybe Richard says that to him, but one of them
makes a real Ocean's 12, yeah. Like Julia Roberts moment. And I didn't have a ton of patience for that. But it's so bizarre to think that, like, she's only in her 20s here. I mean, she's dead by 36, yeah. Which is only like 5 years from where she is here.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, it's more than that, 7 years. But yeah, it's very strange to see, I mean, this kind of film, because it exists in like an Americana canon of like much like James Dean, like there's only a finite amount of material that exists that shows why people are so obsessed with this thing that the monoculture is obsessed with.
And only a finite number of chilies that have a framed picture of her dress coming up from the subway grate, which is the iconic shot from this movie.
Yeah, I mean, if there's no other takeaway here, it's the much copied and whatever, yeah, the skirt going up because of the subway.
The Madame Tussauds of it all.
Incredible, yeah. The aforementioned subway and the heat that rises thereof.
Why don't we just start with that? I spent one summer in New York. I visited you in the summer in New York a couple of times. I don't really recall subway wind coming up through the streets. Is that still a thing, or am I just not remembering?
No, it's definitely a thing.
Do people stand on it, or is it the grossest thing in the world if it blows up on you?
I mean, it's kind of scary to stand over those grates where you can tell that, you know, there's not a ton separating you and the train tracks. But I think it's somewhat of a Hollywood wink. I mean, only the first shot and the last shot of this movie are actually in New York City. Mm-hmm. The rest of it's very much on a soundstage. But yeah, it's in that space too, where like there's probably a leaf blower that like did some lifting in that. I don't think it would like lift a woman's skirt.
Have you done this?
I've tried. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm alluding to. And it like was disappointingly, maybe like there was a flutter in my skirt, but there wasn't like a full lift.
Yeah. The much more relatable thing is where Marilyn Monroe wanders over to the air conditioning in Richard Sherman's apartment and just kind of does the wind pants next to it. I think we've all experienced that in the last couple of weeks, if we were lucky enough to have a fan or AC of some kind.
Right. You know what's more New York accurate is how often I slip on beads that have come off of necklaces when people are like chasing each other and then they like break it off like in Home Alone 2.
Is that true? Are you joking?
That is an epidemic in the touristy parts of town. You're just constantly banana slipping on your butt. No, I'm of course joking.
So this is a movie that originated as a 1952 play by George Axelrod and Tom Yule, who plays Richard Sherman, the husband with the wandering eye and wandering imagination, is playing the role that he played on Broadway. He was more of a stage actor. He preferred it. And I believe this is his best known, cinematic work.
My eyes a little when he's like, I'm 38. I was like, okay. A gentleman's 38, perhaps.
You should have stopped smoking 12 years ago, if you want me to believe that.
Yeah, your doctor should have told you much earlier that smoking was not the way to go.
Exactly.
How many Tom Collins is he going to put away?
Right.
You ever had a Tom Collins?
I actually can't say I have. You?
No, I was looking up the recipe while I was watching, though. I was like, that sounds pretty refreshing.
Sure.
If I drank more, maybe I'd have a Tom Collins.
The alcohol mixing in this movie is pretty funny. I think there is a moment before they decide to go in on a whole bottle of champagne where Marilyn Monroe says, I'll have a glass of that, a big tall one. And he makes her like a pint glass of gin and vermouth, both of which I think checks notes are alcohol. That's like nine drinks.
Well, it's just a big martini.
Right. Six martinis a pint glass full in one of glass.
Yeah. And she's like, oh, I just want to, maybe I should add some sugar. He's like, if I can tell you nothing in this life, it's don't ever add sugar to a martini.
Hmm. That's the last
So let's talk about the premise of this movie. Because I feel like, so Billy Wilder, of course, The Apartment. Yeah. Some Like It Hot.
Double Indemnity.
Yeah.
Sunset Boulevard, Ace in the Hole.
One of
the great American directors.
And one of the sort of at the forefront of the romantic comedy and even the kind of comedy that we'll see in Weekend at Bernie's, I would say.
You can kind of see it in this movie. Like, this movie is playing with like sketch.
Yes.
Way more than you would think it would.
Absolutely. That being said, I have to say from the jump, as like winky as some of his other movies are, this is maybe one of the more dated conceits that's very much like it's having fun with the madmen of it all, but it's like not maybe as aware of the inherent problems that, like, the Peggy Olsons of the world faced. So much so that, like, Marilyn Monroe doesn't even have a character name. She's referred to as the girl.
You don't think that was a family name?
I don't. I don't think the girl was a family name. So, like, and off the bat, trigger warning, the first scene of the movie, the cold open of the movie, is 50 white actors who have been, whose skin has been darkened to resemble Native Americans, who then, the joke is that, you know, since the dawn of populations existing on Manhattan Island, you know, women have, like, wives have gone up to Maine for the summer, to the Hamptons for the summer, and men have stayed around to hunt and gather, or hunt and what was it? And to work and to
trap.
And
to fish.
Yeah. There's very little fishing that happens in this movie. But yeah. And so this very dated, sort of unforgivable sequence happens that I don't think, it isn't saved by the premise, you know, it's kind of like one on the other. And that's the first 5 minutes of the movie. And then, of course, it's like the establishing shot of 1955 New York, which is like beautiful and charming. And, you know, everyone's wearing these great suits and like everything's really prim and proper and everybody's got a secretary. And yeah, this guy, you know, you sort of, it sort of has an interesting American beauty-ness to it. I was talking about this movie with a podcast favorite, Brent Rivers, the other day. And I mean, I would be too afraid to watch American Beauty. Like, I may never watch it again. But the idea of you have this, like, here's typical Manhattan guy who's, like, getting home from work one day at the publisher he works for. And it's like the Lester Burnham monologue in his head, except he's saying it out loud. Tom Yule is saying it out loud. Which is kind of hokey, but it's like that thing where he like invents things that are like spectacular, you know, and right. it has that sort of like white guy who's feeling sad and stuckness to it, which, you know, in the lens of like a 1955 humorist, my God.
I think if there is any sort of even-handedness or a saving of this premise, it's just that Tom Yule plays Richard as very non-threatening, which I think if he had even an ounce more of intimidation to him would be a million times worse. And I do like Evelyn Keyes as Helen, his wife who's gone up to New England with their son, as she kind of like reappears in these various sketches of being like, oh yeah, Richard, what an imagination on you. Recently it's been in CinemaScope and Stereophonic Sound, which is a nice wink. And then she comes back and shoots him a couple times. But yeah, I don't know what I think of that performance as a whole. It's
the Tom Yule one?
Yeah, sometimes it's cute, sometimes it's a little annoying.
He's an incredible physical performer, and I think if there are saving graces of this movie, it's the physical performances and the chemistry between Marilyn Monroe and Tom Yule, which is like, I think, pretty good. But yeah, but I don't know. It's like really from the jump that just the setup of like men after 7 years, they give up on their marital loyalty and their fidelity, and man, it's hot outside.
And therefore it is so.
Yeah. But it definitely does. But I will say that the movie knows that this guy's like a schmuck. And it doesn't romanticize him bumbling at all, you know, and it's interesting to see like what this movie says in kind of a, you know, a Winkies 1950 way, both about like urban living, but also about, because I think the movie is smart to introduce the fact that like the guy works at a publishing company and he's like working on a book about men exactly like him whose psyches are breaking down, especially in the summer heat. So I think the movie is smart in that way. But yeah, it's like Battle of the Sexes humor is is quite tough.
Is it Battle of the Sexes though, or is it like someone playing racquetball alone? I mean, and that's
it really
what's so
is. Yeah,
curious.
Like different faces of different women like come up on the wall that you're hitting the ball against, but you're not playing anyone.
Well, yeah, sometimes he imagines there's another woman playing racquetball with him and beating him very badly.
You hit the nail on the head there, because the idea that he never really like spars with any woman beyond the ones that he's concocted in his own mind.
Right.
It's like women don't have the wherewithal to surprise him. And what happens is that Marilyn Monroe just turns out to be like exceptionally chill.
Right.
Even though like he like makes at least two fumbling passes at her.
Yeah. What do we think of Marilyn Monroe in this movie?
Oh, she's incredible. I love how she has the ability to like, if it was in the stage direction or if something she just made up in the moment, but the idea of like, hey, have you ever tried a potato chip in some champagne?
That's
it's
nice.
Crazy. Like, just being able to deliver like a line like that is so good.
I think she needs like 20 more of those moments, to be honest. I mean, I kept trying to find ways, you know, reaching for like, in what ways is this subversive? In what ways is this, does she have control over the sort of sex kitten bombshell persona? Which is like, people have written scholarship about that forever. Wondering, you know, how much authorship did she had? How much was she shoved into a box? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think she's really, really good at what the movie will let her do. Like, when she just sort of pops out from behind that chair, it's amazing. Like, she's figured out that, like, one of the things they will let me do is try to shatter the camera lens with my face appearing. And she's great at it. Well, you know what I feel like is the... Well, you can tell me if this is true or I'm misreading some textual element of this, though. Doesn't it seem like she is more interesting and acting better in the sketches? Like, it's more fun to see her play the sort of French Russian woman who's overacting when he plays Rachmaninoff, and then it comes back to real life and she's actually more airheaded. Now, you could say that, you know, the whole thing is basically like a projection of Tom Mule or someone like Richard's visions of women, and that's half the point chance. But I don't know, that felt kind of damning to me.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm hinting at, is they're like, they are making fun of his like outdated and outmoded ways of thinking about women, but they don't really like present women in that flattering of a way outside of his imagination, which I think is what I got tripped up on.
It's kind of like the Zoe Kazan movie Ruby Sparks, except if she wasn't a figment of his imagination.
She's real.
Yeah.
She's real, and she's far more interesting. I will give, on the entertainment value side of this movie, I will speak to the fact that Tom Mule smokes incredibly well.
Hmm.
Like, the cigarette as like a physical object that he's like constantly close to setting things on fire with or burning himself with, but doesn't. And then the way he like makes the smoke kind of emphasize like when he's, I don't know, upset about things, how he's thinking about stuff, and like getting the cigarettes too, I think is such a great bit. Like finding the key and then when they're out, it's got a sitcom-y-ness to it, you know, where it's a lot of physical gags all in, you know, like act one is basically all in the like the living room of this house, and the way he kind of navigates the, you know, the stairway to nowhere and the different rooms, and he's like, oh, now he needs to get the ice. He's like always in the back of his mind getting, you know, trying to be a good host, and sort of the narrative tethers him to that. So seeing him be like, oh, I can't do this, like my wife is going to be so pissed, you know what, we need ice, and then he'll like run off to do that, which is so...
He has to return some videotapes,
this guy. But like, the way you bring that up, but I think he's like a bit of a psycho.
Sure. And the fact that he's reading books about psychotherapy doesn't make him any less of a psycho.
No, that his pathology's been recorded doesn't mean he's not insane.
Am I a grump for wishing like a little more had happened? This is not like a common criticism of mine, but like, you know, he and Marilyn are in a scene just talking to each other for 25 uninterrupted minutes and they don't talk about anything.
Yes, you do kind of want more to happen, especially for a movie that's what, almost 2 hours long?
But I guess that goes back to the 45? Like they're not playing tennis thing. And that's so weird. It's like they don't really.
That's the thing. I think it's a better movie if Marilyn is more sort of like surprisingly with it. Like even if it's not just like wordplay intelligence, but it's like her kind of spider web a little bit more.
That's... Or just has more of anything of her own going on. Like I really relished the moment where she actually, it's supposed to be a joke about how she's like, you know, distractible and in her own world, but where she's talking about like, what if I return the first fan to the drugstore for $3 off and buy a bigger fan? And I'm like, I think this joke is at her expense, but like, I want to know what's going on in her mind.
Right. Anything. And she probably should get a bigger fan. It seems definitely very hot. And it does. You know, the people upstairs spend all this money on African art, but they don't spend any of it on air conditioners.
I want to ask about...
That's a line from the movie. That wasn't my own judgment.
Yeah. I want to ask about Krahulik, the janitor played by Robert Strauss. And I want to ask...
The racially ambiguous...
A Mediterranean janitor.
Yes.
Have you ever encountered anyone who is sort of like a self-fashioned... just fan of infidelity? Like he comes across a situation of suggested infidelity and he's just like, yes, well done. This is quite the rule breaking you have here. He's an odd
Well,
character.
I hadn't met anybody that way until the next act where you meet Donald McBride's Mr. Brady, who's like, you trying to go out there and fuck tonight? Like if this movie had been 20 or 30 years later, like that dude would have been, I don't know, some goofy actor that Apatow put in a movie where he's like, you trying to go out and fuck? Like, you trying to fuck?
Instead, he's like, you and I could traverse the town and inspire a hootenanny.
Yeah, they would inspire quite the hootenanny. Of course, Yule's not up for a hootenanny tonight. But it is interesting how the morality of the characters kind of has like the bumpers of those two guys where it's like, well, at least Richard isn't this bad. Like right. At least he has doubts, yeah. You know, he's not fully on board with the animals that are out there in the world.
Yeah. There's not wearing like a foam finger to cheer on his id.
That's it. That's there it. There's some self-awareness there.
You know who I did like is, was it Tom McKenzie? Yeah, Sonny Tufts, who's this guy who every time Richard calls his wife, he's, you know, and he's constantly like thinking about going on a moral holiday. And he's always like, what, Tom McKenzie's there? You're going on a hayrack ride. And this is like some author that he either he has worked with or he sort of knows incidentally. But then like Tom McKenzie at the end of the movie charges into his house, just the biggest chest I've ever seen on a man in like a bumblebee waistcoat. Yes. And Richard confronts
he's
him.
Got
that's
that
a good
Kurt
scene.
Douglas triangle body thing going on.
But like proportionalized to like 240 pounds.
A big dude.
That's an enjoyable...
And that's funny, too. Like, that, in the last act there, like, the script does have fun with that dude literally only being there for the canoe paddle.
Right.
Or the kayak paddle. And, yeah, and Richard's just, like, on his knees giving the game away.
This was kind of a confusing one.
It has the trappings of good stuff, you know, like... It's fun to see the script be really playful and you can tell it's based on like a well-done play. You know, you kind of have the other one I liked is the Chekhov's roller skate where like, definitely. Of course you can't find the second roller skate and that's going to come into play.
Yeah, it calls it out.
I liked the wittiness of, and maybe this is just homophobia, but the wittiness of, yeah. Oh, there's two guys who live upstairs. I think they're both interior decorators or something and then totally move on.
Yeah, I think one thing that should be said is that the legacy of this movie is how much Billy Wilder was fighting the Hays Code. So, like, little things like that that seem euphemistic and slightly undercooked or asides are, like, I think, his way of getting around these things. Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, well, the other thing, too, is, like, even the first time that Marilyn and Richard kiss, they're, like, almost, like, consumer sponsored kisses, like, because they kind of do the gag of like, no, the toothpaste really is this good and I'll show you. And that also feels like ever so slightly like, fuck you, Hays Code, because Billy Wilder in later years was like, in the play they sleep together, which makes this, gives it an entirely different, oh, more volatile God. Dimension of reality, which I do think would have been a more interesting movie. I would be fast. I have the movie I watched today. I have zero idea how it would have handled that turn. And Billy Wilder in later years was just like, he literally said, I wish I hadn't made it because we couldn't do the actual source material.
Interesting. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
True or false, Tom mm-hmm. Ewell is, if you put Simon Pegg into Frank Whaley.
That's good. Well done.
Thanks.
True. I give it
took
a
me
true,
a couple
true.
Minutes to...
is that where your mind was drifting off to when I was talking about Tom McKenzie? Why yes. don't we tell people how we rate movies on this show and then rate the 7-year inch?
On Be Real, we rate movies in two categories, good or bad for technical quality, and a good or bad for watchability. So what are the four possible ratings?
I don't care!
Good movies are both well-made and highly entertaining. The Fugitive, Parasite, Rear Window, or The Hunt for Red October.
Once more, we play our dangerous game.
Good bad movies are often impressive technically, but also tough sits. Historical melodramas like The Mission, horror movies too scary or gross to rewatch, or self-serious musicals like Yentl.
Papa, can you hear me?
Conversely, bad good movies are highly flawed but still gratifying. Nonsensical hangouts like Hot Tub Time Machine or ludicrously fun action fare like Twister or Stargate.
Give my regards to King Tut, asshole.
Bad movies are neither well-made nor entertaining. Examples we've covered, unfortunately, include Garden State, 50 Shades of Grey, and Attack of the Clones.
I'm deeply sorry, Master.
Got all that? Time for a rating.
I think that this is pretty quintessential good-bad. I think it's a little long in the tooth, in both its politics and its ways of comedy. But I see the importance of it as a historical document and how it definitely influenced, television sitcoms, and then, of course, like the rom-coms that we see made today, including one that we'll talk about in a couple of seconds here. But yeah, I think it's, and for that reason, it's, but because of being dated, it's hard to sit through.
Yeah. I'm totally in agreement. I think, you already made one Mad Men reference. Every time I look at Billy Wilder's filmography, I'm struck by like this guy invented Mad Men essentially between this and The Apartment and Double Indemnity.
Right.
Like so many of the things that like different characters, you remember when Trudy leaves and Pete's at home for the weekend, but there, if there's Mad Men, like later doubles back on the darkness that you think would right. be in a movie like this, where Pete sexually assaults the helpless au pair upstairs. And right, that right. feels more... And Billy Wilder himself, like, in a movie like Double Indemnity, or, Jack Lemmon's darker moments in The Apartment. And Shirley MacLaine is sort of, has a little Peggy Olson in her in that movie. I think he's done more to be more incisive, and this one is just sort of light in a way that just doesn't make sense much anymore. So I'm going to go good bad as well.
Yes. Yeah, I don't mean to indict the career of Billy Wilder here. I think he has much better and more lasting films.
Oh, like this 10 one, of them.
Exactly. So it doesn't feel that icky to be like, hey, the 7-year itch, while a time capsule...
Yeah,
is not that good of a movie.
Okay. From Manhattan to Brooklyn?
1989's Do the Right Thing. On the hottest day of the year, on a street in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, everyone's hate and bigotry smolders and builds until it explodes into violence. I would be a little bit more specific if I were to write the synopsis for this one, potentially mentioning the pizza place, which is kind of the fulcrum of the plot, if you will.
Right.
So there's, it's all kind of the, so we have this particular block and it's the story of the people in your neighborhood, but then it kind of looks at the smoldering resentment that exists between the historically black residents and the two outside groups, mostly the Sal's Pizza Place and then the Korean grocery store. That's a little wordy though. So I'm sympathetic to the scribe of this synopsis.
Did you spell everything right in your hypothetical synopsis though?
Neighborhood with three B's.
Two B's. Boy, there's so much to say about Do the Right Thing. I don't think I'm overstating anything by saying it's probably one of the best American films ever made. I mean, it's for me, it's Spike Lee's best movie.
Yes.
Yeah. No?
It's one of the best ones.
Sure. It's inarguably.
I would say this one has more staying power, perhaps, than some of the other ones I really like.
You are like a big She Hate Me guy, right?
Get out of here. I'm a 25th Hour guy.
Sure.
And I think several of those collaborations with Denzel are pretty good. I think Mo Better Blues is kind of an unappreciated 6.0 on IMDb is a crime, I think.
Mo Better Blues is much better than that. Anyway,
but
there's so many different ways to talk about Do the Right Thing. I think one of the, I feel like I've watched this like once a year for the last 6 years somehow. I really love this movie. And one of the worlds that you get to live in Do the Right Thing, and we'll talk all about the ending, of course, you have to. But for a movie that you know ends with an incredible tragedy, it is an incredibly enjoyable movie to live in for a good chunk of like 90 minutes. So it's almost like the sort of powder keg element is ever present and must be analyzed. But it's also like you don't spend the whole movie being like, this is smoldering, because otherwise you wouldn't watch it over and over again.
Ooh-wee. It's going to be a scorcher today.
Universal Pictures presents a new film from Spike Lee.
Good morning, Miss Mother Sister.
Now, Mookie, don't work too hard today. The man says it's going to be hot as the devil.
I've been here 25 years. Well, Sal's famous pizzeria is here to stay.
Trust me.
Mookie, the last time I trusted you, we ended up with a son.
I know you can't stand it. You can't stand it.
Hey, Sal, I'm going to bust for the wall here.
You want brothers on the wall?
Love.
Get your own place. You can do what you want to do.
1989, the number. Another summer.
What'd I tell you about that noise?
What'd I tell you about them pitch?
You coax some brother talk to him.
You the man.
No, you the man.
No, you the man.
No, you the man.
The first time you turn your back, boom. Right here, man, in the back.
Y'all take a chill.
You like to sign a petition to boycott Sal's famous pizzeria?
Hear me, what you ought to do is boycott that no good barber that messed up your head.
And that's the double truth. Rude.
Fight the power.
Yeah, you maybe don't say this is smoldering, but I think what Spike Lee's really good at, especially in this world, is that he makes a strong choice for all of his characters, and they all have, anytime you're with them or see them pass by in the fore or background, you know what they're doing. They like have a desire, you know. Mookie's just like trying to get paid. He's trying to like do the amount of work that he's being paid for, but otherwise, like, this isn't his life. He's not a pizza delivery guy. He's the guy who's delivering pizza, but is also doing the thing that he needs to do to make rent and trying to keep the peace at the same time. You know, you got bugging out Giancarlo Esposito, who's incredible in this. He just wants a face that looks like his on this wall of fame of this Italian restaurant that doesn't serve Italian people. You know, why wouldn't the fame be more... He's kind of arguing for, and this is such a reductive way to put it, but you know, like in Applebee's, they like dedicate one wall to like the local high school. Like, he's really just searching for the community building that, you know, seems to have already come naturally to larger food corporations. So Sal's really should have gotten on board.
Applebee's beat Sal's to the punch on that one. That's quite an indictment.
That's it.
Yeah. Do you want to run through more people?
Oh, and of course, like, I think one of the more fascinating dynamics is between the two brothers, Vito and Pino, mm-hmm. Richard Edson and then John Turturro, respectively, where you've got these, like, two hopped up, hot, both, I would say, like, in attractiveness and in temperature, young guys who just, like, need to blow off some steam, and the only people that they feel comfortable being intimate with are each other. And that has turned into, like, this toxic, like, no, fuck you. No, fuck you. No, like, fuck you. Like, hey, dad asked me to do this. Like, go do this kind of relationship, which I think is really, you know, as this movie ages and, like, looking at it, like, through the context of, you know, the larger cultural reckoning that happened in this time last summer, this one feels so present. Like, it feels so of now, too, you know, especially when it's looking at just the anger that it feels like these sort of masculine white people have, where it's like, mm-hmm. this is mine. Like, you're trying to take what's mine. And it's like, you're not listening to what people are saying to you. Mm-hmm. Like, do the thing that people are asking you to do. Do the right thing. And it becomes a story about anger and property that is like that's really the fulcrum of the plot.
Yeah, Turturro is so loathsome as Pino. I pretty much forget it's him. It's such a great performance. I don't really recognize him as John Turturro from other things I like him in.
I just think of Turturro as like a kind of a hunched over guy scratching at his feet, you know, from the night of.
You're all about that eczema representation. So, yeah. One of the things, what you're talking about is just incredible, like, stage management by Spike. Well, I mean, watching this movie, it's amazing when you just sort of see Ossie Davis's Demare shambling through the background of another scene, or the same group of friends with Martin Lawrence just going down that block over there. Or I never noticed from inside Sal's, you can very clearly see the Korean grocery. You can very clearly see Paul Benjamin and Frankie Faison and who plays Sweet Dick Willie, Robin Harris. You can see them on the red wall across the way. Like, they're... One of the things that's so amazing about this movie is it has this, like, lived-in, authentic quality to it, but at no point would you really call it realist. Like, it feels, like every Spike Lee movie, it feels larger than life. It feels extremely theatrical. Anytime you're like, that character is the Greek Chorus, you're like, well, buddy, four of these characters are the Greek Chorus.
Yeah, that's almost too easy of like a structural read on it.
I know. Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, that the opening title sequence is supposed to be an homage to Bye Bye Birdie.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like in that key, like, you almost expect people to break out into song at some point because of the stagey kind of, it does feel similar. Maybe this is why it's a Heat movie, Urban Heat, but it does feel similarly stagey, I would say, to the 7 Year Itch. You know, where you kind of know that you're never leaving the block here.
Right.
And when you're in the pizza place, like, the camera's not going to, like, go up through the chimney of the pizza oven, like, into some David Fincher world. Like, you're in this set.
And one of the things I really love about it is the lighting in this movie is incredible. I just watched a movie, and I don't want to, like, come for it too harshly, but it was kind of like these all-in-one-day youth in a city movies set in LA. And one of the things that kind of gave it away was, like, it was the golden hour from, like, 11 to 8. And that, when you're watching a one-day movie, it's like, that is a little suspicious. You just wanted every scene to look great. And one of the things about this movie is you can tell that the front window of Sal's faces east. It is morning light. You can always tell what kind of time of day it is until you, like, enter someone's apartment and it's just like, you know, a little box of hell, that sort of like infernal kind of lighting, where it's just like, we have to go outside just to remember that, like, we're human.
Yeah, the apartments kind of feel like labyrinth worlds where, like, it's, you can shut 17 doors, but you're, like, somehow still in the same room with your mother that's screaming at you and, like, the baby that's crying. And you, like, yeah, Lee is very good at, like, navigating the claustrophobia of being indoors when it's very hot. That's smart.
I found myself this time really appreciating Bill Nunn as Radio Raheem. I mean, it's really easy to get on board.
Talk about Radio Raheem.
It's really easy to appreciate, like, the iconography of Radio Raheem, the classic D motherfucker D's, 20 D batteries. And, you know, it's always a testament to Fight the Power being just such a good fucking song that it can play 12 times in this movie. I never get sick of it.
Lee finds good moments to play, like, specific lyrical exchanges, I would say, too. Like, I think it's really important that it hits the verse where the line is like, Elvis means a lot to some people, but I just saw him as, like, someone who was racist who stole black people's sound.
Motherfuck him and John Wayne.
Yes, exactly. But, like, having that juxtaposed with, you know, the mostly Italian, or the entirely Italian Wall of Fame, where it's Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, who parenthetically turned down the role to play the Danny Aiello Sal part. Mm-hmm. But it's all these, like, famous people. Joe D, old Blue Eyes.
Yeah, you're right. He's choosy about it. Which is great. But Bill Nunn also, there are, like, all these little moments where you just kind of, it's not just that one ice cold stare. Like, I love when Frank Vincent gets his car soaked by the hydrant, like, right before he pulls up in the vintage car, Radio Raheem comes past, and, like, the look that he gives Martin Lawrence and company, that's like, guys, like, don't even make me give you this look. I am going to walk down here. And they're like, yeah. That's a great moment of nothing acting. And Sarah pointed out that, like, you know, Bill Nunn has kind of a baby face. And I think that if you made that character scarier or more menacing and less human, you would really ruin final resonance, and also just, like, what he means to everyone in the neighborhood. He is as much a person to everyone in the neighborhood as Mookie is.
Yes. Well, that's the thing, too. He's such a presence in the film because, like, Fight the Power is so prevalent. Like, you know that, I mean, it helps the performance, of course, like, because you know when you hear that song that Bill Nunn is not far away.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's so interesting, too, that, you know, when you kind of boil that character down and you kind of ask, like, when he is, like, where is he going? You know, like, where is he going with this huge boombox? And he's not going anywhere. He's just kind of doing laps with everybody else because he can. You know, and there's something just so fascinating about the giving that character so much agency, but also, like, that being the thing that the other characters are, like, afraid of or push back on. Like, your music's too loud. Like, don't bring that in here. That's, like, how Spike Lee chooses to represent that, like, whatever that annoyance, that, like, not on my lawn kind of thing about it. This really embodying it in this stereo, in this song. It's a good choice.
Mm-hmm. Part of the reason you know this is, like, top tier Spike is without the surreal interludes, it would still be a great movie. But then you have, like, the love and hate monologue with the brass knuckles, and then you have the thing that he recycles in 25th Hour with everybody doing the racial diatribes direct to camera, and you have the I can't stand it, and everyone's, like, taking a shower and starting the hydrant, and God, and the detail of, like, scratching the edges off the can lids on the sidewalk. Every time he chooses to go to a higher plane, it ends up being an iconic sequence too, and it's just like, geez, I mean, like, everything was rolling in this movie.
Let me ask you this, Chance, and this may be controversial, but does this movie not have the Spike Lee shot?
It's Noah, for those who don't know, is teasing me because I failed to identify the dolly shot in Defy Bloods, even though in retrospect it was very obvious. It's really fast. It's just Sam Jackson in the swivel chair coming toward the radio desk being like, everybody cool it or hold it. It's like split second.
Interesting.
Split second.
But it's not like Denzel running with no arms moving, but the whole world's like flashing behind her. Got it.
And that's the one that was so obvious, I think it fooled me for all time. It was like, will it? They all look like this?
Yeah. Interesting.
Sam Jackson, though, is so great in this movie. And what a great presence.
He is great and a great presence. And, like, I think that character does such fascinating work, too, to kind of, like, show, you know, like the tenor of what's happening hour to hour, you know, like when he's playful, it seems like the world is playful. And when he's hungry, it seems like everybody's running to the pizza shop.
Great point.
You know, he's kind of, it's unclear like who's dictating what, like is life imitating art or is his, what he's saying imitating or influencing what's happening with the people outside. And I thought that was, that layer of it is sort of interesting.
Totally. One of the things I think we have to talk about with heatwave movies is I think that this one, and Jesus, my job is nowhere near as hard as delivering pizzas up six flights of stairs, but how fucking hard is it to work when it's this hot and keep your mind on your work? Like when it was 114 degrees outside and it was 97 in our apartment, I mean, the first night, a weekend kind of felt like summer camp. It's like, let's just crowd in the air mattress with the fan and watch movies, and that was okay. But the next day where it's like, I got to go in the other room and edit and teach. It's 97 degrees in here. Like, and that's where you, like, the stomach sickness starts to creep in. And everybody's, you know, giving shit. I mean, definitely with like racist undertones of like Mookie's sort of effort level at different points on behalf of the pizza shop. But I also just kind of felt like that's an accurate representation of a day that hot where, like, if you get four things done, like, that's the whole day because time and physicality have like warped completely.
Chance, I've said it before. I'll say it again. Fuck the cops.
Yeah.
Not great in this movie.
No. This movie kind of baits you to, or it baited me at least, in the first, when they show up, when they first pop the hydrant, there is a sense of which, like, they are not, if not part of the community, like, present in the community. Like, this is the beat of these two officers. And, like, they don't really give a shit about Frank Vincent's car. And there's this sort of, like, do you care to give a description, sir, kind of thing. And their familiarity with the place means fucking nothing in terms of them murdering the people that they're charged to protect.
Yes. Well, it shows the limitations, again, of these, like, sweaty, angry, hot, tired, hungry guys who, like, really only have reports and violence to throw at things. And, you know, they can come in and turn the hydrant off and they can take a statement about your car. But, like, what do you want me to do about it? You want me to chase down a couple of guys who got you wet? Like, that, I think, is Spike Lee's... his subversion here is like he kind of makes the cops seem almost human and just like Mookie, like doing a job on a hot day. But then, like, as they get more introduced and you see like the where they can go and like how the system will play out when they feel like control is actually lost, like it's not just threats and, you know, bureaucracy, it's actual violence, which, you know, I think this is one of the early times of us really seeing images like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something kind of tough about reappraising this movie, Noah, considering it essentially does the, it does the say their names, remember their names thing for Eleanor Bumpers and Black Brooklynites murdered by the police 35 years ago. And so there's something about like coming back to it the way that you and I tend to do to movies and be like, it's so prescient, or it does this thing that I think is relevant now. And it's like even making that point is like a little sick because of how long it's lasted and how long it's taken and how little, you know, the motherfuck your window, Radio Raheem is dead is like a debate that plays out to this very second, and there's almost nothing to me that's like intellectually poignant about pointing that out. I was thinking a lot about, there's this comedian I really like named Ayo Adebiri. She's on a bunch of podcasts. I think she took over for Jenny Slate on Big Mouth. But she did this review of Do the Right Thing on Letterboxd last summer, at the height of the protests after Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, which was just like, we make these movies, her meaning coming from black artists, and you all, white people, can make a Letterboxd review of it. You can say that it's very prescient. You can say that it's very poignant. You can say, you know, thanks for the empathy machine. Thanks for the window into this world. And it just doesn't stop. And that's kind of, it's not an indictment of this movie. It's just sort of like an indictment of the world and how this just keeps fucking going. And if you'll allow me one more thing, this is what I think the thing that is good about this movie, what I would have considered to be the sort of grating Spike Lee excess of the morning after and the insurance money and the Martin and the Malcolm quote at the end. You know, I think when I first saw it, I would have been like, you got to end it with Smiley pinning the thing on the wall and it's rage and it's fight the power. And now I think like it's not solutions necessarily. It's like the difficulty and the necessity. And again, Sam Jackson is the one who's just like, tomorrow is tomorrow. Today's forecast hot. And the system's going to come here and do what they will do. And that's kind of like what the Mookie character embodies, is like, tomorrow is coming. And as much as it's an instinct of people to hate each other and kill each other, it's also an instinct of people to stay alive until tomorrow. And to me, like, that's kind of the resonant, or the part that's what resonated with me this time, is that in a sick way, you know, the beat goes on, and that's human too.
I think the aforementioned sort of larger cultural scope of this movie does make the, you know, the needle go a little bit good bad, but I think it's definitely a good.
There's so many enjoyable parts of it.
Yes. I almost think now I feel bad about the thing I said, my assessment of the film, but I do think what's good about this movie is that it is a good movie, even without the climactic, and the timeliness of the climactic part of it.
Totally.
Like, it is about the world, and this particular incident is, I mean, it's climactic for the characters involved, and it is the necessary scream of all these people not getting what they want simultaneously. It's a good movie beyond that.
Absolutely. Even as I was watching it last night and hearing my own voice in my head, I'm like, I'm already sick of hearing myself, my own voice, talk about the politics of this movie. It's like, you know what? It's going to be okay, because every frame of this movie is great in some way. It's not something where like the political read supersedes like how fucking awesome it is. Good.
Same year. 1989 was the year of Hot Summers.
Such a kinship between these films.
Weekend at Bernie's. Two losers try to pretend that their murdered employer is really alive, leading the hitman, what hitman, to attempt to track him down to finish him off. This terrible... Just end it with alive, but don't get into the hitman, because then you got to explain that the hitman killed him before they got there.
True.
Ugh.
No, this is one of my favorite kind of movies for us to do, which is a movie that, like, everyone knows the premise, because they're like, oh yeah, that's like Weekend at Bernie's, but never seen it, and have not had, like, many, like, this is what is going on in Weekend at Bernie's beyond dragging a dead guy around. I didn't even know if he was really dead, if he'd been murdered. There was so much about the movie I didn't know.
I have to, like, rewind a little bit and ask, like, are there a lot of things in culture where you're like, oh yeah, that's like Weekend at Bernie's?
Yeah, like,
other than that Daniel Radcliffe movie.
Swiss Army Man.
Are
there a lot of things in culture? I don't know. There's like a Weekend at Bernie's reference in The Office. I feel like when people are like joking about like moving their bodies around in weird ways, someone would be like, oh, it's a little bit like Weekend
at Bernie's. It does seem like in pop culture, at least from my vantage, that when, even though I had not seen this movie until now, and people said, oh, it's like Weekend at Bernie's, in that rare instance, I would understand what they meant.
Yeah, but if someone was like, it's like Andrew McCarthy's character in Weekend at Bernie's, he would be like, what? There are characters in it?
Don't you see? Don't you see? We just uncovered a $2 million error. We're going to be heroes. We're going up the corporate ladder. It appears as if somebody's trying to defraud the company.
Somebody tried to smoke it past the wrong guy.
Very, very good work.
How would you two like to come to my house at the beach?
Love to!
For Larry and Richard.
How are you?
This is a place to die for.
You have to kill them, Vito.
I'm a little rusty, but it'll come back to me.
What, should we just walk in?
But what they don't realize...
No, we'll stand out here on weekend. Come on, we're out yet.
...is while they're checking in...
Forget the accident with the two guys. Take care of Lomax.
Bernie Lomax will be checking out.
Oh, my God!
What kind of a host invites you to his house for the weekend and dies on you?
I don't know.
It's a pretty flimsy movie, as every critic of it has pointed out, in that there's not a ton beyond beating the summer heat that these two recent college grads are trying to get into, other than like go to their seemingly rich and successful boss's fictional island beach house.
It's compound. Looks like fucking Pablo Escobar's Museum of Art.
It does. And it's got this like weird roof, but it's like not really a roof. It's like a Miami Vice beach house with this like weird, like, with a, I don't even know how to describe it.
A dash of Air and Space Museum.
It's like a sukkah above it. Stop describing what the house looks like.
Our two losers are Larry Wilson and Richard Parker, the tiger from Life of Pi. They are played by Andrew McCarthy. What?
Wait, I'm sorry. How is the character from this movie affiliated with Life of Pi?
Richard Parker is the tiger's name in Life of Pi.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
Andrew McCarthy,
Jonathan Silverman.
Yeah.
What a duo. A real Chance and Noah.
God. Which,
you're
please
Andrew
don't.
McCarthy.
Okay, great. Wonderful. We could start right at the front here. Like, this is, as a comedic duo, I think they've miscalculated just a little bit. However much you can miscalculate when there's only two figures in the equation. But Larry, the Andrew McCarthy character, he's sort of like the instigator, the wild man. And Richard Parker, played by Jonathan Silverman, is the more like, you know, Owen Wilson in Wedding Crashers. He's trying to make it happen with Catherine Mary Stewart, who plays Gwen, who also works at the same company and ends up out on the Hamptons with them. He should be the more earnest, more worried of the two. But there's some inherent miscalculation in here where he's also the worst person of the two. And he, like, lies a lot more, so it's impossible to root for him. So then I go back to Larry, and I'm like, am I supposed to like Larry? Because he seems like an insane person. More superficial, but lies less.
That's an interesting point, and a good point. It never really draws that hard line between, like, who's the straight man and who's the funny one.
No. Bernie's the straight man.
Well, then that's the thing, too. You not only have these two guys playing off each other, but then this dead body that refuses to deteriorate.
Sarah...
How much do you think... sorry, go ahead. How much do you think of it is Terry Kaiser, the body of Bernie Lomax? How much do you think of it is him? And how much do you think of it's like a doll?
I think it's Terry Kaiser, except for in the insane scenes where they're like dragging him behind the speedboat, which parenthetically is my favorite scene of the movie.
But that's like pretty compelling dead body acting when he's like, they're like really tossing him around. He's like, you know, he's sack of potatoes.
Oh yeah, I think it's going back to like, you know, the fucking James Lipton 101 of like, and now pretend that you have no muscular system. And he's, Terry Kaiser's like, great, this is just like in school, slump.
I guess, yeah. What is your favorite visual gag?
That Andrew McCarthy wears long sleeve crew necks under Hawaiian shirts.
Okay. Wow, that's impressive, where there's a movie with the premise of a dead body is being kept ambulatory by two losers. You pick what one of them is wearing.
Well, for a heat wave movie, it was just a little distracting, if I may say. You tell me yours. I think mine was the boat, dragging him off the boat.
I liked the really angry, douchey little kid who kept burying Bernie and then would otherwise just go out of his way to fuck with the two guys for seemingly no reason.
It's a late addition. He's a late addition to the movie.
He does come in late, but then he like provides that nice final tableau for the film.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. You remember how in the Willy Wonka episode I got upset about if it was real Germany? I think in this one, it was my wife, Sarah, who I forced to watch this with me early on a Sunday morning, who just every 10 minutes would look over to me and be like, when does rigor mortis set in? He wouldn't float if he weren't decomposing. Isn't this a heat wave movie according to you guys? Why is he not decomposing?
Why doesn't he fucking smell?
Should have watched that.
That was
myself.
Huge question.
Oh my God, he would smell so bad.
Like, quickly.
Yeah.
He would smell bad that first night.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they are living in a world where people don't recognize a corpse when they see one is patently insane. But I've also like read some interesting takes on this movie that like it's kind of a sort of Stepford Wives-esque thing where people were so kind of blinded by the light of late 80s commercialism and capitalism, like because he has all of these toys, like he's there, the big house is Bernie, like the golf cart that looks like a Porsche is Bernie, like it's seeing him on that boat, it's not seeing him. And like that is maybe the larger critique of the film.
What a searing takedown of zombie commercialism in the Reagan era.
Absolutely. But I don't know that the movie ever like cares that
no,
much about
I don't
that.
Think so.
I well, think it's a pretty deep read.
There is definitely a lot of the stupid stuff in the movie that, like, just for instance, like them getting distracted by really superficial things. Like there's this joke at the end that's like semi-offensive if it weren't such a throwaway, where Bernie was going to like frame the two guys in the murder-suicide by doing this sort of like Dog Day Afternoon ripoff. Like one of them was taking $100,000 for a sex change surgery and then killed his partner. And Andrew McCarthy's like, look what he's making me out to be or whatever. And Jonathan Silverman's character is just like, he was going to kill us. And it's like a stupid joke, but you could feel like the defense of the movie is that all these characters are so shallow that they're like missing the forest for the trees here. And I think there could be a little bit of that in terms of like, and just the decisions that characters make moment to moment are like, do we want to get on with our lives and potentially go after, get either A, get out of the situation, or B, get anything that a coherent character would want? And Andrew McCarthy's like, I think there's more champagne over there. Like, let's stay till morning and I'll get something to hold up Bernie's hand with. Something is keeping them there.
Well, it's also part of this, you know, kind of like late 80s, early 90s, like how long can I keep a gambit going movies?
Uh-huh.
Where it's like Secret to My Success. Like a lot of Michael J. Fox movies are like sort of this ilk.
Just parts that Andrew McCarthy didn't get.
I would even put Big into that as well. But yeah, this is definitely the weirdest premise of all of those, I think. But maybe that just speaks to my larger indictment that this is about the excesses, the blindness from the excesses of the Reagan 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I was
like his boat. cool boat. I feel like I know how to drive a boat now after watching Andrew McCarthy.
There you go. What I was going to say, though, was everything happening in the movie is patently insane. But did you ever feel like, given that, the movie was extremely like flat as well?
The lack of noticing that Bernice is dead is, you're right, it's insane. But I would agree with you that the guy tries to pretend he's cooler than he is to get with girl Gambit is like not that groundbreaking. Which feels almost like this movie feels like it has a lot in common with The 7 Year Itch in that the premise of it kind of is maybe bigger than what the, or maybe less than like what a script can do in a movie length narrative. So both of, I mean, I think what we found to run long about the first one, you know, I think with this one, they're just trying to stuff it full of John Hughes. Like, how do I make the girl like me stuff? Mm-hmm. And that's really what props up the, because what's Andrew McCarthy's like goal in this movie? What's his desire? Like, he has zero.
None. He's just like, there's more food over
there. Other than to not work. But yeah. He's like not trying to do anything.
One could argue, you know, this is, it's generous of us to call this a heat wave movie, but it is like the opening 5 minutes where they're like stepping in tar on the roof and going to the unair-conditioned office on a Sunday, where it's just like, that's doing a lot of work. Where if they leave Bernie's compound, like that's all they have to go back to is heat wave stuff.
Yeah, that's a classic climate change story.
Mm-hmm.
The haves and the have-nots.
I think in time I will view this as a bad good. I would rewatch. Immediately after
this... How much
time? Yeah. Well, it took 4 years to make Weekend at Bernie's 2, so talk to me in 2025, and I think I, like McCarthy and Silverman, will want to do it again. So I'll, in that generous light, give it a bad good, because it is crazy and you know, ambitious in certain ways, at least in Terry Kaiser's acting. Yeah, I was maybe a little less high on it when I wrapped it up this morning, mostly because my wife was like, you wasted 95 minutes of my life, and he didn't decompose once.
No, his body is very flexible. It's like a G.I. Joe, but very big. And he doesn't even really, like, he gets a little dirty, but then they kind of like, he like goes to take a nap and he's clean again.
Yeah.
Like, what happened there?
They vacuum him.
Yeah. Shout out to Catherine Mary Stewart as Gwen. She's the often put upon actress yielding this pretty flimsy role of the love interest. But she's... She seems there for it, and I actually kind of do like the moments where this movie shows you kind of like the creepy men. There's a lot of like creepy men. I mean, there's a lot of creepy men everywhere, but a lot of creepy men like in these three movies. And this one, like, there's a scene where there's a party and these like older gentlemen are like trying to, they're shooting their shot, as it were, with Gwen. And she's like, no, thank you. Like, this is sick. But I think having those moments where it's like not, they could have made Bernie's set like a lot more douchey and gross.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'm saying. I give it a bad good.
No, are there other, if I just say like sweaty movies or heat movies, are there great images from other movies that come to mind that you thought about when we did this category? Anything?
I think you could, like, it deserves its own credit. Ted Danson's sweat from Body Heat. Really the whole cast, but Danson is like, the sweat acting he can do is like the assistant district attorney or whatever. It was very impressive. Body Heat.
Ted Danson's in Body Heat?
Fuck yeah. Didn't we already do Body Heat?
I just don't remember Ted Danson.
He's like the second billed guy.
Not William Hurt.
William Hurt is the protagonist of the film, and his sweat is pretty good.
That you're, but good job. Yes, that's like the sweatiest. That's some of the best sweat ever. I had like Cat on a Hot Tin Roof has some great sweat in it. Speaking of like liquor on the porch, and I did say roof right now. That was unintentional, but that is how I say
it. I heard it. I wasn't going to say anything. It's been too long.
You know, Rear Window, which we've done on the show. That's
it's hot.
There's a sweat river coming through that leg cast that I would never want to experience myself.
I feel like people are pretty sweaty down there, wherever they are in out of time.
Oh, yes. Well done, Florida.
I feel like Sanaa Lathan does a lot of sweat acting in that one.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, we probably shouldn't get into like desert movies. That's its own thing, obviously.
Well, I think there's like desert. There's like desert. There's also like bayou and or Florida heat. So this is just New York heat. We'll travel around. Yeah. That's my pledge to you.
I keep throwing out Cujo for categories because they get so hot in the car, and then it turns out Cujo's 2 hours and 44 minutes. I'm eternally glad we did this instead. Rabid Dogs.
Save that for
244.
Save that for Dog Buddy Pictures. Turner and Hooch is a comedy? It's actually a dog buddy picture. I don't know about you, Chance, but after this podcast, I'm pretty hot.
Mm-hmm. I thank you for continuing to sweat out these ideas with me. It won't be it won't hopefully be the last summer that we have to sit in on air conditioned rooms, because we don't want background noise on these recordings, damn it.
That's our commitment to you, dear listener.
That's right. Cause I can't edit that shit out.
Well, Chance, please do not cheat on your wife while she's away on vacation.
Thanks
this summer.
For that advice.
I'll try not to prop up any of my dead bosses to get access to their beach house.
And a third personal reference to Do the Right Thing is not necessary. I bid you a good podcast, and I'll see you soon.
Bye, buddy.
Hot town, summer in the city. Back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead. Walking on the sidewalk harder than a match, yeah. But at night, it's a different world.